The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see time is of the essence?
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts.
From St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking.
The emergence of the Delta variant is prompting a strong reaction from Missouri's local and state governments. But some conservative lawmakers want to make it harder for private businesses to enact policies like COVID-19 vaccination mandates. Democratic Senator Greg Razor of Kansas City has a lot to say about these ideas, and he joins us on the latest episode of Politically Speaking to break down the governmental reaction to the virus and the impending special session on congressional redistricting. Let's hit the music.
This is the Politically Speaking podcast, the definitive show about Missouri politics.
We have to talk about things that matter to people.
I've tried to bring that same aggressive, iconoclast style with me to the United States Senate.
I think my district is a model for the state.
We put Missourians first.
You just kind of have to find the common ground with people.
I believe that this district deserves someone who represents their values.
After I came back to St. Louis, I started thinking that I could have a bigger role on the change that I wanted to make.
And welcome to Politically Speaking. I'm your host, St. Louis Public Radio political correspondent Jason Rosenbaum. Joining me from Kansas City, Missouri, he is the state senator for the state's 7th district. Our guest today is
Senator Greg Razor.
Thank you, Senator, for joining us today. We have had somebody from the 7th district before on the show, but that senator was Jane Cunningham, who represented the 7th district when it was in St. Louis County. So we are breaking a little bit of ground on this show. Can you just explain to our listeners the general boundaries of your district?
Sure. So my district is essentially half of the core of Kansas City. So for your listeners who understand Kansas City, my district is downtown all the way to the Cass County, Jackson County line, from State Line to Troost. It includes the city of Grandview and parts of Lee Summit. I share the core of Kansas City with Senator Washington, who represents the parts of the city that are east of Troost, which is historically kind of the racial boundaries of our city.
I want to start off this conversation by talking about the Delta variant surge in Missouri. We've talked a little bit about this with Governor Mike Parson in an episode of Politically Speaking that you can find on our website or wherever you get podcasts. But I wanted to get the perspective from Kansas City about how Kansas City is handling the pandemic now that it has kind of reared its ugly head again.
You know, I mean, like the rest of the state, we're seeing numbers go up, primarily through the unvaccinated. It's putting a strain on our hospital systems, on our first responders, our doctors, our nurses. Our businesses are getting wary. The first round of COVID that hit this time, you know, last year or early last winter, there was no vaccine. We had to, you know, shut down and mask up and to protect everyone. This time around, there is a clear solution. Get vaccinated. Hundreds of millions of people, myself included, have been vaccinated. We are protected, not from maybe getting sick, but we are protected for the most part for getting sick to the point that we're going to have to be hospitalized. You know, we have rid the world of polio and smallpox and other diseases through vaccinations, and we can do that with this virus as well. But we have to do it quickly. We have to get the message out that these vaccines are safe, they're readily available, and the quicker we get the majority of Missourians and Americans vaccinated, the quicker we can put down our mask and stop having this fight and get back to life as normal.
I'm going to play a clip now from Governor Parson from our wide-ranging conversation. And it was based off a question where I asked him about people in the state who have, I'm going to just be candid here, have become deluded with insane conspiracy theories about the vaccine and seem like they are going to be intractable when it comes to convincing to get the shot. Here's Governor Parson.
Yeah, well, first of all, I don't necessarily agree that I think everyone's like that. I think that's a very small minority of people that's like that.
Yes.
But I will say this too, Jason. I think the reality of it is we have to face the fact that there is going to be a certain segment of the population that's not going to take this vaccine for whatever reason. Some, whether maybe it's Christian values, maybe it's some other reasons they have it. Maybe women decide for some reason what they've heard or read, they don't think so. Again, I'm going to go back to what I said. When people like myself as governor, we have a leadership responsibility to encourage people what we think is the best thing to do for them, for the safety of them. The one thing that we should be is the safety and health of the people of our state. For me, I believe the vaccine works. I don't know what the outcome of the vaccine is going to be 3 or 4 years from now. Nobody does. But I think for the time we're in right now, if you want to save lives, I think the vaccine is definitely the way to do that.
Now, what do you think of the governor's comments?
Well, first of all, the first thing that struck me is the phrase, I believe the vaccine works. I agree with him. The only difference I would make is take out the word believe. The vaccine works. We are seeing it now. We are seeing a rise in this Delta variant amongst the unvaccinated. This is not something that is happening to the vaccinated. So the vaccine works, period. I do agree with the governor that there is a certain percentage of the population that for whatever reason, they have decided they are just not going to get vaccinated. Despite the fact that this is a vaccine that was fast-tracked by President Donald Trump, despite the fact that this is a vaccine that the major logistics of getting it distributed was through the Biden administration, this is a nonpartisan health emergency. And while there are a certain number of people who likely will just never get it, we have to do everything we possibly can to encourage every Missourian that's encourageable to get out and get this vaccination, protect themselves, protect our state, protect our country. And I would go back to the quote that Senator Blunt had a week or so ago, where he said, we're now in a race that's between the vaccine and the variants. And the quicker we can get the vast majority of Americans vaccinated, the less chance we're giving the virus to mutate into something that the vaccines don't protect. We're lucky that this Delta variant can be controlled by the vaccine. But if we continue to let this virus run through the unvaccinated population of our country unchecked, then it's going to mutate around the vaccination, and we may end up back in a spot that we were in last winter, which is something no one wants. So, you know, the vaccine works. We have got to start convincing Missourians and Americans. You're hearing it from Republican governors from Arkansas, from Alabama, being very forceful in trying to encourage citizens of their state to get vaccinated. It's something we've got to start doing.
So because the Delta variant is so prevalent in Missouri right now, a number of local jurisdictions have taken it upon themselves to re-implement mask mandates. As I'm sure you know, in St. Louis County, that's been very controversial. And in fact, the county council, which is a majority Democratic institution, by the way, actually voted to rescind St. Louis County Executive Sam Page's mask mandate. Like, it seems like the legislative will may be there in Kansas City and Jackson County to make those stick beyond 30 days. Is that a fair assumption? Or do you think that you're about to go through the same troubles that St. Louis County went through?
You know, my sense is that Kansas Cityans and folks in Jackson County, no one's happy that a mask mandate is back. But we understand that there is a deadly virus back on the loose in our communities. And we all have to wear the mask. because I could be, even though I'm vaccinated, I could be a carrier of the virus and spread it to someone who is unvaccinated. And that person could end up in the ICU and unfortunately end up dead. And so I think the frustration that I'm hearing from my constituents is we have done everything right. We have gotten vaccinated, and now we're back to having to wear these masks to protect people who are refusing to protect themselves. Mm-hmm. The frustration is not with the mask mandate itself. It's that we're back to having to do this to protect our neighbors. So I encourage folks to get vaccinated. The sooner you do it, the sooner we can stop wearing these masks. The sooner that small businesses can stop worrying about, you know, are they going to see a decline in business again? Are we going to have a shutdown again? All these things, the longer this lasts, the more likely these scenarios are going to pop back up. And we have a simple, safe, proven solution to prevent it. And that's getting vaccinated.
So another thing that I think is going to become more common, especially after the Pfizer vaccine is fully approved, most likely in early September, is you're going to see a lot of businesses and institutions start mandating that their employees have to start getting vaccinated. But some of your colleagues actually want to call a special session to ban private companies from instituting vaccine mandates. I asked Governor Parson about his reaction to that idea. Here's what he had to say.
Well, first of all, we won't mandate anything from the governor's office to be able to do that. The private sector is the private sector. I think it's always a tough decision to do that balancing act. Do you require somebody in private business and own their own business to tell them whether they can do a mandated vaccine or not? So far, we're not going to go down that road. If that business decides they want to do that, you know, we're going to allow them to do that in this state till something changes to show us different. You know, but I would also point out, it's like the healthcare industry right now. There is a shortage of healthcare workers right now. I think the last thing in the world you want is somebody that's been on the front lines for 18, 19 months that's dealt with this and been dealing with that. Do we want to lose any healthcare workers over a mandated vaccine? So, and there is some hesitancy within them, within their organizations, to be able to do that also. So, again, I'm going to go back. We want to get as many people as we can to be able to make sure they're safe as we can.
What's your reaction to the governor's comments there?
I agree in part. I think that we don't want to lose healthcare workers because they're unvaccinated and then get sick. Here in Kansas City, I know Truman Medical Center, which is our safety net hospital, is requiring employees to be vaccinated, I believe, by September 20th. I support that decision. I support businesses that want to protect their staff. They want to protect their customers. I know we've had some local bars and restaurants in Kansas City say that, so that when their staff comes into work and their customers come in to dine or have a drink, they know that the people they're sitting around are also vaccinated and are protected. As far as a special session goes, you know, I think the folks that are calling for that, they don't want discrimination against the unvaccinated, which personally I find a little ironic because these are also the same people that fight me every year when I say let's not discriminate against LGBT people in public accommodations. And so now they're turning around and wanting to, ban discrimination based on vaccination, but not for me.
I've seen a quote from the New York State Teachers Union about how they do not support vaccine mandates for teachers. I have not talked with teachers unions in Missouri, but it seems a little odd to me that a lot of teachers unions like want masking and other precautions and may even want to go to like virtual schooling under dire circumstances, although not all teachers want that. I want to make that clear. But they wouldn't be in favor of a vaccine mandate, especially when they're going to be around unvaccinated kids. Would you encourage school districts to tell their teachers and staff, like, you have to get vaccinated or you don't have a job?
You know, each school district is going to have to make that decision. I would think that no one wants to go back to all virtual school. That was a necessity last year. It's not a necessity this year. We also know that kids are not just little adults. And so we need more research before we can vaccinate at certain ages. So that means we have to protect those kids. And whether that is masking or requiring vaccinations or a combination of the two, we have to do it. We want to protect the teachers. We want to protect the staff and the administrators at the schools, and we want to protect the students. Again, all of this comes down to a safe, effective vaccine that would end this argument if only people would get it. That's where we're at today. There is a way out of this. It would take about a month. Most of these are two-shot regimens that are 3 weeks apart. If everyone would go today and get it a month from now, we would be through with this conversation.
We'll be right back after this quick break with Senator Greg Razor.
If you have a smart speaker, you have access to the entire world of NPR and St. Louis Public Radio. All the latest news and all the captivating stories. Activate our voices with yours by telling your smart speaker to play St. Louis Public Radio.
And we're back on Politically Speaking with Greg Razor. He is a Democrat from Kansas City. I want to move on to the other big news that has affected Missouri, and that is the Supreme Court decision about Medicaid expansion, that the 2020 amendment is valid, and that the state has to start signing people up who make up to 138% of the federal poverty level. What are you hearing from your colleagues about how they're going to respond to this decision?
So here's what we know. We know that the people in Missouri voted on this and wanted Medicaid expansion. We know that the governor, to his credit, began last legislative session respecting the will of the voters. He submitted a plan to CMS and put the expanded population into his budget. So the governor was ready to do this. It was the legislature who decided to take it to court, and now the courts have ruled that that amendment was constitutional, and these additional Missourians have every right to be enrolled into Medicaid. So the people have spoken. The governor was willing to put that in the budget, and now the courts have spoken. This idea that there are two different groups of Medicaid population simply isn't true. There is the Medicaid population. And every year, virtually every year, we have to come back and pass a supplemental budget because you never know how many people are going to enroll in Medicaid each year or what kind of medical conditions they're going to be needing. So that number fluctuates, and what we put in the budget and pass during the legislative session is an educated guess. And every year we have to come back and add some more money to that. We have a $2 billion surplus in the state of Missouri. Is this going to require an additional supplemental budget? It does every year. And this year will be no different. So it's time to enroll folks. And let's talk about who these new folks are right now. These are folks that are likely working jobs. They're likely the folks that are working at your local gas station. They're working at your local fast food restaurant. They're doing everything that we say we want people to do, but they're working in jobs where their employers either can't or don't provide health insurance. And so this is saying if you get sick, you can go to the hospital and take care of it. And I just think that is the moral, responsible, and now legal thing for the state of Missouri to do.
Because of the American Rescue Plan, there's a provision in there that says if you're a state that hadn't expanded Medicaid under the auspices of the Affordable Care Act and you end up doing it, Missouri is going to get around $1 billion because they expanded Medicaid. And ostensibly, that means that they can pay for the state match for the foreseeable future. Eventually, that money is going to run out, though, and I don't know how much the state match will be in 3, 4, 5 years. Some people think it'll be around $200 million. Others think it'll be negligible because you can move people that are currently in the Medicaid program into the Medicaid expansion pool where the state cost is less. But it seems to me like it gives the legislators leeway to come up with some permanent funding stream to pay for the state match. Is it time to shift to that mentality and not like, you know, is Medicaid expansion going to happen anymore?
I believe so. Medicaid expansion is going to happen. Again, the people have spoken, the courts have spoken, it's going to happen. When you hear, you know, the kind of the sky is falling rhetoric from the other side, they rarely mention, you know, like you said, that $1 billion coming in from the federal government. They also fail to mention, I mean, just look at our neighbors to the south, Arkansas, arguably a more red state than Missouri. They've had Medicaid expansion for a while, and they have not reversed that decision. None of these states that have expanded has then turned around and said, oh, my goodness, this is destroying our state budget. We have to stop. So obviously the sky's not going to fall. We are going to have more people insured. We're going to have more hospitals open, which means more jobs for people in those communities, et cetera, et cetera. This is going to be a good thing for the state of Missouri.
We talked about special sessions earlier, and one of the special sessions that I think is very likely is that lawmakers are going to come back to pursue congressional redistricting. This year, Missouri has the same amount of congressional districts as they did in 2011, so 8. But there's going to have to be some changes, like the first district is going to have to expand into St. Louis County. I think there's an expectation that Republicans are going to make the second district, which is represented by Ann Wagner, more Republican. But I think the reason I wanted to talk about this with you in particular is there is this kind of lingering anxiety amongst Democrats that Republicans are going to take the 5th district, which is held by Emanuel Cleaver and includes much of Kansas City, as well as 3 rural counties that are east of Kansas City, and then turn that district, which is now, I think, a plus 6, 7, 8 Democratic district, into a Republican district. Are you one of those Democrats that have that fear?
You know, I mean, it's something we obviously want to protect our district. This is you can look at Kansas City and our representation. This is a blue part of our state. But I think reasonable people in the Capitol understand that if they were to carve up Kansas City and gerrymander it in such a way that it takes Kansas City and forces Republican legislators upon it, that's just a bad idea. It's not something that I'm overly worried about. Obviously something that we'll be watching. I think it's important to keep in mind that the census data is behind. We're not really going to get the detailed numbers until sometime in October. So we don't know what these census tracts look like. I've seen people take guesses of how you might carve up Kansas City. What I've seen is ludicrous, just from an obvious standpoint of what, you know, taking Kansas City and carving it into 3 different districts. I don't think reasonable people will allow that to happen.
And I'm not in the camp that thinks the 5th district is going to be turned into a Republican one for a couple reasons. Number one, if you do that, you have to take parts of Kansas City and put it into the 4th district, which is held by Vicky Hartzler now, but is going to be part of a free-for-all because she's running for the U.S. Senate, or into Sam Graves' district, which is an expansive district that goes across the whole north part of the state. I just do not think that national Republicans want to be put in a situation where those districts suddenly become competitive in a wave Democratic year, and they have to spend a lot of money to protect them just so they can oust Emanuel Cleaver like next year. Frankly, a lot of Republicans have told me that, which is why I just think it's going to be a 6-2 map, and that's probably going to be it.
I mean, I think you're likely right. On a national level, that would be a lot of money that would have to be spent, you know, in the Kansas City media market. They're already spending that money on the other side of the state line with Congresswoman Sharice Davids. You know, I think on a more local level, yeah, I'm sure the National Republican and National Democratic parties have their ideas. And I'm what I'm about to say is in no means trying to attack any current member of Congress, but they're all going to be protective of their district boundaries. And if you look at, you know, Congressman Graves' district, which is the majority of northern Missouri, he has a big hunk of Clay County, which is rapidly expanding and turning blue. You know, I'm sure he's not wild about that. I think you're going to get more territorial about how these congressional maps are drawn. Not to mention that when Senator Blunt announced his retirement, it started a chain reaction of people running for his Senate seat, including several members of Congress. But now that means that there are several state senators who are going to be looking at running for those open congressional seats. And each one of those senators are going to want those seats drawn in a way that will benefit them. So this is going to be a convoluted kind of bitter debate, I think, especially amongst my Republican colleagues as they fight to draw those districts in ways that benefit each of them individually and what they foresee as their race. I suppose they could try to break up the 5th district, but I think they have other fish to fry.
I think that the actual biggest impact of the map could be how the 2nd congressional district changes. Right now, it's literally a 50-50 district. I think that Trump won that district by like 100 votes or something. But Ann Wagner won re-election by 6 over your colleague, Senator Jill Shoup, who was an excellent candidate by all measures. I guess Democrats could try to stop that, but even your colleague Senator Lauren Arthur mentioned on the show, like, they don't you don't really have any leverage to really stop them from making that like a 56-57 Republican district.
You know, yeah, I think I would agree with Senator Arthur. I mean, we're in a super minority, so there's only so much we can do in this congressional mapping process. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, when we're drawing these districts, where we put people, are they Jefferson County centric? Are they St. Charles County centric? Are they St. Louis County centric? I think you're going to get into some greater St. Louis metro Republican battles that, frankly, as a Democrat from Kansas City, you know, I don't know how much we will be jumping into that or how much say we will have. I think it's also important to know that for a lot of us, it's our first time going through this process. I was not in the legislature in 2010 because of term limits. And then even a lot of the people who were in the legislature in 2010, especially in the Senate, you know, they were probably freshman House members, so not in leadership, not in the middle of those discussions. So it's kind of a downside of term limits that, you know, you have a bunch of folks that are kind of going through this for the first time, and we're going through it together. So we'll see how this plays out.
In the last couple minutes we have on the show, I do want to talk about your impressions of this session, because there was something that happened to you on the very end of session that I wanted to flesh out a little bit more. You actually fainted from exhaustion, I think the last day of session or next to the last day of session. Is that correct, first of all?
Yeah, I mean, I'll just be honest. I had a seizure.
Oh my gosh.
We had gone in, so session ends at 6 p.m. on a Friday. We'd gone in that Thursday before in the morning. It was around 4 a.m. Friday morning. So we had been in session for about 20 hours. I remember we took a controversial vote on the Senate floor. I remember getting up to walk back to my office, and that's the last thing I remember. I do want to say that I've, you know, seen neurologists and had lots of tests done. It was there's no indication that it was anything other than just exhaustion and dehydration. So I'm okay. But we do work incredibly long hours. There are a number of members of the Senate and the House of varying ages and health conditions. I know I've talked to friends of mine in the Kansas legislature. They have had members who have fallen asleep driving home and unfortunately have passed away. You know, a lot of, not just the members, but our staff, a lot of them live, you know, in Columbia or in surrounding communities. I worry about my staff who live in Columbia. And when we're leaving at 4 a.m. And we've been there for 20 hours and now they're taking a 30-minute drive home, that's worrisome. And I'm not sure it's the best way to create public policy. You know, it's not often that I agree with Senator Moon, but there was a situation on legislation that we were debating. It had been filibustered for several hours. This would have been in February or March. And finally, the negotiated bill was passed out and handed out to us all around 6:15 a.m. So we had all been there for about 22 hours. And what we were handed was essentially a new bill, and we were going to vote on it right then after 22 hours of work. And Senator Moon stood up and said, is this really the way that we're going to create public policy in the state of Missouri without time to read the bill? And when all of us are naturally absolutely exhausted. And I agree with him on that, that's probably not the best way of doing business. It's not good for the people of Missouri. It's not good for the legislators. It's not good for our staff. And I really want to emphasize the staff. There's a lot of people that work for us individually, that work for the institution of the Senate, that make sure that we're typing up bills in the correct legal way, that are documenting what we're doing to make sure it's legal. All these things have to work together. And, you know, when you're working multiple 20 plus hour days, it does get difficult to make sure that everyone is safe and that we're doing good public policy. Mm-hmm. So I hope that's something that we can address.
So maybe this is just bias on my part because I'm around so many politicians as part of my job, but I have increasingly become disillusioned with this idea that we treat government, especially legislative government, like a volunteer charity board, and that we don't pay legislators enough for where they can make it their main job, so they have to have other jobs, or that we only have something like the state legislature, which is making incredibly important policy decisions that affect 6+ million people in session for 5 months and cramming everything into like the last week of session. Now, I know that there are a lot of people in Missouri that do not want to go to a full-time legislature, that do not want to pay legislators $50,000, $60,000, $70,000 a year. And I think it's kind of a moot point because I don't think we're ever going to go to a full-time legislature in Missouri. But isn't this episode kind of a good indication that the way things are going now is not really working?
Well, look, first of all, I want to say that I don't think I'm the only person that had a medical incident. And I won't be the last. It becomes difficult for me as a sitting member of the legislature to advocate on the things that you just talked about because no one wants to hear it from a legislator. But the fact is, we do make, you know, very little money. I am a single man, so I am kind of able to do it. If I had a family, there's no way I could do this job. So the people that are left either have to be retired or independently wealthy or have some sort of financial situation to where they can step away from a job that actually supports them to do this. And so that really narrows the field of people who can serve. We also, you know, we're in session for 5 months of the year, January through May. So if you do want to find another job, it's very difficult to go to an employer and say, hey, I would like to work for you for 5 months of the year. I really can't be there. And while this is technically a part-time job, you know, I'm still doing a lot of work when we're not technically in session. We have interim committees. We're doing constituent work. Of course, you know, as a state senator, I had meetings yesterday with the Kansas City Chamber of Commerce. The school district's going to want to meet with me. I have multiple school districts in my district, all these different groups and people, and you want to listen to them and gather that information before we start session back. And so it becomes increasingly difficult to find a job that can accommodate that kind of a schedule. You know, do we want to look at going to some sort of a full-time legislature? Maybe we can mitigate paying full-time salaries by looking at the makeup of the legislature itself. We have a huge disparity between the number of House members and the number of senators. That's something I've heard tossed around, is reducing the number of House members. These are things that we all could look at. I think years ago when Missouri passed term limits, we probably did a good thing by passing term limits, but maybe we're a little overzealous. So it takes, you know, like you said, we're a state of 6 million people and what, a $35 billion budget. It takes a while to kind of wrap your head around that and how all of the systems work and work together and don't work well. And by the time you start to figure that out, you're kicked out of office. And so the person that replaces you then has to start the learning process all over. So I don't think I would advocate for ending term limits in Missouri, but perhaps we should look at an extension of them just a bit so that we don't lose all the institutional knowledge, which now is held almost exclusively by staff and lobbyists. And you've seen that in the Capitol building. I think it's a problem. And it's probably something that needs to be addressed.
Well, thank you, Senator, for your time. And we'll be watching to see what happens in the weeks ahead with congressional redistricting. For all of our stories, stlpr.org. Politically Speaking is a product of St. Louis Public Radio, which is part of the University of Missouri St. Louis. Find me on Twitter at Jay Rosenbaum. And how can people follow you on Twitter or any other parts of the World Wide Web?
Yeah, you can find me on Facebook at the office of Senator Greg Razor, on Twitter at Senator Greg Razor, I think it's S-E-N Greg Razor, and on Instagram at Greg_Razor.
Thank you very much, and until next time, so long.